So I will round out this portion. No relationships to disclose, no financial conflicts of interest. I'll quickly go through that to get us back on track. So a couple of things that hopefully the first part of the presentation will help to characterize why this is an important issue. Obviously, you're self-selected to be in this presentation, so you probably know most of this. But hopefully it will say why what you've heard from everybody else is really important as we think about being public health practitioners and clinicians in addressing this issue. So this comes from the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, SAMHSA's annual survey, and it looks at abuse or dependence on prescription opioids or heroin and the trends over time from 2002 to 2014. And you can see here these are trends that we would like to be seeing going in the other direction. But about 1.9 million people met diagnostic criteria for abuse or dependence on prescription opioids in 2014, and a little bit less than 600,000 for heroin. But there's actually quite a lot of overlap. Among the heroin users, about 45% also meet criteria for abuse or dependence on prescription opioids. So it's I present them as two separate metrics, but there is quite a lot of overlap. And then when we look at the mortality data, again, why is this an important issue? And many of the people who are dying from prescription opioid and heroin overdose deaths have an underlying opioid use disorder or substance use disorder. And we can see here a pretty dramatic spike in heroin-related deaths in the last couple of years, more than doubling between 2010 and 2013. You can see a little bit of stabilization in prescription opioid deaths, which is the blue line here, but still, if you added up prescription opioids and or heroin deaths, you would see year-over-year increases from 1999, so continuing to go up, a significant problem. And there's actually a really nice paper that came out yesterday that probably some of you saw around non-Hispanic whites, middle-aged people, that among many other causes of major causes of death are declining, yet in that population we continue to see pretty dramatic increases in drug overdose is one of the underlying factors for why we continue to see that. So from a public health perspective, I don't know that outside of people who work within substance abuse, have we really appreciated the overall impact to society. So as I mentioned, there is quite a lot of overlap. This is a paper I did with colleagues from CDC this summer that looks at people who use heroin in the past year and what other problematic substance use are they reporting. And you can see here for alcohol, marijuana, cocaine, and opioid pain relievers. Really, the black bar, which is prescription opioids, is where you see the most consistent trend. But I was just interested in seeing how much substance use generally there is among people who are using heroin. We often look at it as a single issue. But when you think about the complexity of patients and what you saw from previous presenters earlier about what are the treatment needs, it's really important to take into consideration the complexity of the patient, that you may have a medication to treat their opioid use disorder, but you don't necessarily have a medication to treat some of their other issues, but they still need to be treated. And then really trying to understand what's happening with the heroin deaths. Again, this is from the same study with CDC colleagues. And you see a pretty tight correlation between increasing rates of heroin abuse or dependence and deaths related to heroin. And I think it stresses really the importance of medication-assisted treatment and access to high-quality substance use disorder treatment. And then when we look at who's most at risk for heroin abuse or dependence, this is national data based on SAMHSA, National Survey on Drug Use and Health. You can see here males 18 to 25-year-olds, non-Hispanic whites, people living in large urban areas, people with lower incomes, people who are uninsured, and those in Medicaid population, which you already heard about Massachusetts Medicaid population. And then again, people with substance use disorders outside of an opioid use disorder. And this accounts for their underlying demographics and other substance use disorders. So people who have alcohol abuse or dependence are 1.8 times more likely to have heroin abuse or dependence. For marijuana, it's 2.6. For cocaine, it's almost 15. And for prescription opioids, it's 40 times the risk. And again, I think a lot of the research in the last years that's tried to look at the relationship between prescription opioids and heroin has focused solely on prescription opioids and heroin. And part of this was to really understand that it's a broader polysubstance use issue. And I think we can't overlook what we're seeing across the country, primarily in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states, now some in the Midwest, of just emerging synthetic opioids. So, you know, we've got chronic heroin issues in the Northeast, and now that's compounded by acetylfentanyl in Rhode Island and other states, or fentanyl cut heroin in a number of states. And so you can see the map here is from DEA NIFLIS report for the latter half of 2014, and the darker states are those where essentially quartiles of fentanyl reported in the NIFLIS data from DEA, and you can see here those states are, you know, the eastern half of the country, in particular hard-hit states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky. And, you know, that's sort of superimposed upon increasing injection drug use generally, both of prescription opioids and heroin across the country, and that is happening specifically in areas of the country that have been hard hit by prescription opioids. And as people are not having their addiction addressed, you know, they're looking for more cost-effective ways to use substances, and injection is certainly a more cost-effective way than going with oral tablets. And then if heroin is cheaper and more available, then that's a better option. And we know from the TEDS data that about 70% of people coming in for heroin as their primary substance of abuse report injecting, compared to a little bit more than 20% for prescription opioids. And then, of course, Indiana, Scott County in Indiana is sort of a specific example of where you could have a significant issue with HIV as a person enters into an injection community with HIV. And what's interesting is about a lot of the focus has been on HIV in Scott County, but most of the people were also co-infected with hepatitis C. And if you look at the hepatitis C cases, those are long-standing cases. So that's not new to the community. There's been an injection drug problem in that community for some time. It was just the introduction of HIV that rapidly spread the HIV cases. And then just the recent report from Chicago, 74 overdoses in 72 hours. I mean, I think this is a critical public health issue, and that's why I think focusing on access to treatment is so important. And thinking about what are the touch points where we can have that conversation with a patient who needs to be connected to treatment. So looking at a national capacity perspective, this is a paper that I wrote with colleagues from CDC and SAMHSA. It was in American Journal of Public Health this past summer. And we wanted to look at most studies that have looked at buprenorphine capacity have solely looked at buprenorphine capacity without looking at the flip side of what is treatment need. And so we wanted to look at both of those. And so we used the SAMHSA data to look at maximum potential treatment capacity for opioid agonists, so both methadone and opioid treatment programs, as well as data wave physicians for buprenorphine. And then we compared that to prescription opioid and or heroin abuse or dependence in the NISDA data. And you can see here the top line is abuse or dependence on opioids. And then the second line represents the addition of people receiving methadone and opioid treatment programs with maximum potential data wave capacity. So if every doctor who had a 30-patient limit and every doctor who had a 100-patient limit were prescribing at their limit, that's how much we would be able to treat. And you can see here there's a pretty significant gap. And as you heard earlier, and certainly reflected in a number of studies, a large percentage of people who have a data waiver are actually not prescribing, and even those who are prescribing, many of them are not prescribing at their limit. So this is absolutely a best-case scenario, which really doesn't address fully the issue that we have in this country. This is looking at it from the state level, and all the states that are shaded in blue have higher potential need for medication-assisted treatment compared to their potential capacity. So you can see here a pretty significant gap across those states. And this is just another representation of that same slide. You can see here the orange circles that are larger represent higher potential capacity for medication, opioid agonist medication-assisted treatment, and the darker states reflect higher rates of abuse or dependence on prescription opioids and or heroin. And you can see here many of the states fall into the bottom quartile for MAT capacity. And some of the states with the darkest colors, which means highest rates for abuse or dependence, are those with the lowest rates for capacity. At HHS, we're taking a number of actions to address this issue. And we released the Secretary's initiative in March of 2015, which focuses on three areas: improving opioid prescribing, because the epidemiology is pretty clear that the rise in opioid-related morbidity and mortality has corresponded to the increase in opioid prescribing. We want to expand access to naloxone to reverse overdoses, and then increasing access to and use of medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorders. So within the MAT bucket, some of the specific activities that are happening within HHS is looking at research to optimize how it's offered and implemented. You've heard some of that today, some of the barriers that have been identified. And so understanding, are there ways to do this? Are there particular models of care that can help facilitate the reimbursement issues or the institutional barriers that exist? Looking at using FDA's expedited review programs to incentivize development of addiction treatment. We've not seen much new happening in that space. We see some different reformulations of products that are already available, but we have those authorities at FDA that can be used to get people interested in developing products. SAMHSA recently issued grants to 11 states to support and increase the use of MAT, and hopefully now that we'll have budgets, there is additional funding requests in fiscal year 16 to step up that program. And then HRSA recently released an announcement for $100 million for medication-assisted treatment in community health centers. And then, of course, back in July, the Secretary announced that HHS would be engaging in rulemaking related to buprenorphine prescribing. And so we are really looking at the authorities that we have across HHS to address this issue. So one thing that I wanted to talk about was looking at what data sources might be useful to help identify patients. So we know from the alcohol literature that clinicians very rarely ask their patients about alcohol use, and we would assume that discussions around other substances of abuse is even less in the primary care setting. And so there are tools that could help facilitate those conversations and help identify patients who may be in need of treatment. So the first are state prescription drug monitoring programs. They exist in 49 states currently, and they can provide information on the controlled substances history of patients. So you're not going to see heroin in a PDMP, but you will see prescription opioids, benzodiazepines, other patterns that might be reflective of inappropriate use or high-risk use. And it really can be a starting point for a conversation. It is, you know, it's one tool in the toolkit for clinicians to say, it looks like you've been seeing multiple providers to receive opioids. Another data system that exists is the insurers or PBM data. And you saw, you know, the study that was done with Medicaid data, but there are people at state Medicaid agencies, at private insurers, who have access essentially to real-time claims data, who can be analyzing that to identify problematic use behaviors, to identify where people go to the emergency room when there's a claim submitted for an emergency department visit of an overdose. And so thinking about how do we leverage that information in a more timely way to help providers identify patients who might be in need. So many PBMs use academic detailing. Oftentimes they're focusing on cost reduction measures as part of their academic detailing. But it is possible that you could say you're an outlier provider, or these patients have, you know, showed up in the emergency department, they've overdosed, providing that information about what clinicians could do. Alerts to providers, alerts to patients, connections with employee assistance programs. But just thinking about, there's a rich amount of data that could be used to help identify patients and to help facilitate a conversation between clinicians and patients. And lastly, in a similar vein, electronic health records, providing full visibility on what treatments a patient might be receiving, and linking clinical decision support. So thinking about, how do you have that conversation with a patient? I talked to many colleagues. I'm a pharmacist. I was not trained in school about how to do screening brief intervention conversations with patients. I typically am pretty good at identifying when they're walking down the pharmacy aisle who's a problematic patient, but taking that next step is not what I was trained on, and I don't think many clinicians are really trained in that. And so thinking about, is there a way to have a facilitated discussion and using clinical decision support to do that? And so hopefully leveraging these information systems passes on to provision of medication-assisted treatment in the ED, so identifying those overdose cases Rhode Island, for example, does 48-hour reporting on overdoses. So how do they leverage that to identify where problems might be? Are there particular emergency departments where they could put in recovery coaches or others to help those patients and to initiate that conversation? Looking at identifying areas where we don't have good coverage for data wave physicians or opioid treatment programs. Maybe they exist only in urban areas, but you have a rural problem. So using the data to help identify from a policy and programmatic perspective, where can we be more targeted in our interventions? Just a couple of things here. As I mentioned, MAT in the emergency department, this was a recent study that looked at that, which essentially found that initiating buprenorphine in the emergency department was a more successful intervention, and people were more likely to be engaged in care compared to a referral or a brief intervention. Massachusetts, you've already heard some from the Medicaid program, but just thinking about different models of care, they have a recent report that looked at the community health centers in a collaborative care model using physicians and nurse care managers. So you think about right now under Data 2000, only physicians could prescribe buprenorphine, but it doesn't mean other practitioners can't provide care for those patients, and thinking about how do we leverage that to address some of the barriers that physicians may be experiencing. So this was just an example of a successful program within Massachusetts. They found that it was a sustainable model as far as funding goes. And then one small pilot project that I found recently was interesting to me as a pharmacist, but also from a public health perspective, that it was a pilot in a health department, a local health department. But it looked at a physician-pharmacist collaborative for buprenorphine. So again, a very small pilot, an N of 12. But they had really high attendance rates, good retention in treatment. 88% of urine drug tests were positive for buprenorphine and negative for other opioids. And, you know, based on this small pilot, some savings. But I think it's just thinking outside of the local health departments, do this all that much? Probably not. But is it an opportunity? Yes, it is, particularly in areas that are already under-resourced. So just an example of a practice example that could be implemented. And as I mentioned, you know, this is a significant public health issue, and I think we have to continue to shine a light on that. And I think as we have communities like Scott County, or we see, you know, 74 overdoses in a 72-hour period, it really underscores the public health importance of this issue. At HHS, as I mentioned, we have an initiative that's specifically focusing on this. We work across the government with our partners in Justice, with our partners at the White House, in VA and DOD to try to systematically address this issue, and also working with our state and local partners as well as our private sector partners. And as I mentioned, there is really an opportunity to leverage data sources to help from a clinical perspective as well as a policy and programmatic perspective at the state and local level to help target interventions. So there's my email address. If you have any questions, please feel free to send them to me. Thank you.